From the Sky News Centre at 5. LA severe delays when immigration staff go on a heat operator trying to reduce the number of passengers.
They have struck a kind of a voluntary agreement so that you won't have fully laden planes on the way in, so that you will be able to get people through immigration, and those planes will be able to vacate the stands, and you'll be able to get outbound flights as well.
Network Rail is deaths of two teenage girls in 2005. The company is accused of breaching health and safety law. Former England rugby union team manager Martin Johnson says the way review reports of the World Cup were leaked is detrimental to the game. The latest revelations centre on a chambermaid who was allegedly harassed by players, with claims that they were urged by the RFU to pay her five-figure compensation. It's being interpreted by some as hush money, and Johnson says they had to explore a financial settlement.
That was an option that you had. She asked for compensation. An option you could do was to do that. But the first thing you need to do is get your own independent legal advice. The last thing those players needed and the team needed was a story to break on the morning of a game, because we're still there trying to win. We're trying to win matches.
A gang of five who tried to flood the market with fake vodka have been jailed. Officers seized 9,000 bottles of the substandard alcohol branded as Glen's from the group's own bottling and distribution plant in Leicestershire. Free banking could become a thing of the past. The director of banking at the Financial Services Authority says free accounts have distorted the market. Andrew Bailey thinks it was meant consumers have led into buying additional products which might not be suitable. It's being reported actor Ben Whishaw is going to be a fresh younger Q in the new Bond film. The 31-year-old recently appeared in the drama The Hour. He was confirmed as a cast member for the new 007 movie earlier this month. That's the latest from the Sky News Centre. I'm Emily Wither.
BCFM is the award-winning community radio station for Bristol, and it's here to give everybody in Bristol a voice. BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community. Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Hello, Bristol, and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping us review the news this week is South West Region UKIP MEP Trevor Coleman. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, the so-called Broadmead bomber dramatised on BBC Three this week, but how accurate was the interpretation? And also a rare treat for all those who work at Filton and BAE Systems, or MOD, procurement. On the day the Ministry of Defence announced it's lost 500 computers and hard drives, the former South African MP and one of the world's experts in the global arms trade blows the lid on widespread criminality and bribery in the arms industry. And are the final chess pieces being put in place across Europe ready for World War III? Well, we ask who controls the so-called experts now taking over European governments. And Christmas presents to thwart the forces of darkness. No, I'm not talking about the Lord of the Rings box set. Everybody's got that. But three thinking man or woman's Christmas books and DVD gift tips. That's in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute. But first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 6 degrees Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs 13. That's pretty mild again. Fairly cloudy with some showers on Sunday, and also windy on Sunday. Next week, highs of 11 Celsius. Some sunshine at the beginning of the week. Wetter towards the end of the week, and also windy again. Next weekend is the 3rd and 4th of December. Highs of 10 Celsius. Fairly cloudy with some sunny spells. It doesn't sound like a lot of frost and coldness, though. Pretty mild for the time of year, isn't it? That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, time to introduce this week's guests, and joining me is South West Region UKIP MEP Trevor Coleman. Hi, Trevor. Welcome to Drive Time.
Thank you very much.
First of all, Trevor, what was your job before you got into politics? What's your background?
Well, I left school at 15 and went to work as what they call a cattle boy in a yard, a farm supplier's yard. Then I worked in the Matres Clerk's office, and at 21 I joined the police service, serving all over the southwest, and retired 16 years ago with no intention of doing anything except get my golf handicap down to somewhere decent. Then I made the mistake of going to a political meeting, and since that time, 1999, I've been a political activist trying to get the sovereignty of this nation back again.
So you're saying it's almost as if we don't have our sovereignty, and that Westminster isn't really where things happen.
Well, that's precisely right. Over the last 38 years, by the use of some six treaties, the governance or the competence to govern has been transferred gradually from Westminster to Brussels and Strasbourg. And this has been done with the complicit assistance of our own politicians. So that today virtually nothing is decided in Westminster of any consequence, and the laws and regulations and directives that now govern us come directly from the Commission in Brussels.
Well, I mean, you know, the Westminster is passing laws all the time, so of course they're governing us.
Westminster is passing some laws, but most of the laws that come to us are actually originating in the European Union and are just then approved by our government.
So what you're saying is that they're actually, the laws that we're implementing, many of them anyhow, are just, we're being told to implement them by the EU, by Brussels.
We are, and as far as we're concerned in this country, most of the laws and regulations are what they call gold-plated, so they're applied as they stand, and we've been playing, if you like, we've been playing the game with a straight bat, and we obey these laws and regulations much more than perhaps other nations.
Well, how about that? The fact is, you're an MEP, Trevor, so you are the person who surely is making up these laws that are then coming to Westminster, if what you say is true.
No, that's precisely what I'm not doing. The European Parliament is completely powerless. MEPs can neither make laws nor break laws, so they can't raise taxes. We are there merely to ratify the laws and regulations that come from the Commission. And when you bear in mind that apart from the 12 UKIP MEPs, who are the only outers, all the rest of the MEPs, over 700 of them, in the Parliament will patently vote for the laws and regulations and ratify them.
But, I mean, there are other parties around Europe who aren't, surely, who aren't as enthusiastic as most of the MEPs are about Europe. Are you saying that the UK Independence Party is the only party in Europe that's actually criticising the way that the EU operates?
No, I'm not saying that at all. There is some Euroscepticism within the European Parliament, but there aren't any parties in the European Parliament committed to withdrawal and the return of sovereignty to the nation states. UKIP, the 13 MEPs in UKIP in the Parliament, are the only 13 that espouse that ideal. I would also add, by the way, that there is a growing discontent across Europe with membership of the European Union, but this is not represented by their parties in the Parliament.
Now, I'm shocked to hear you say that it's actually not MEPs that are putting forward the new legislation, because if Europe, the EU, is a democracy, that's where it should be coming from. You're saying that actually it's the European Commission. Now, as many people know, the European Commission is unelected. They're appointees, people like, for example, Chris Patten, who was voted out by the British public, people like Neil Kinnock, who was also voted out by the British public. They seem to then go in to become European Commissioners. So what is this European Commission?
The European Commission, as you quite rightly say, comprises of 27 politically appointed persons. We don't vote for them. We can't get rid of them. They meet in secret. They make laws in secret, which are then ratified by the European Parliament. It's totally undemocratic. The whole system is totally undemocratic and corrupt.
But who actually appoints the Commission then? If these are the people who are coming up with the laws, who is actually appointing the Commission? Who's deciding who's going to be the next Commissioners?
At the moment, the Commissioners are appointed by the nation states. So, for example, we've got a lady in the Commission now, Lady Ashton, who was appointed by the then Prime Minister of our country. Soon, though, if the European Union continues to exist, the appointment of commissioners will be in the hands, in fact, of the European government itself.
But if England, if you say Westminster, relinquishes control to Brussels, surely at that point, that's when the EU can actually afford to be properly democratic. And they're not likely to be very democratic until we do cede power to them and that they are sovereign, that the Brussels is sovereign.
The reason that it's not democratic is that it's not represented by the people. When you bear in mind that some six treaties have been agreed to and signed by our politicians, and not one of those treaties has ever been put to the people of this country in a referendum, not one of those treaties has ever appeared on any party manifesto, and never have the people of this country been asked do they want to join this club. That's how undemocratic the whole setup is.
Well, it sounds a little bit worrying. What about the euro crisis? What's your take on that? Because obviously there are a lot of people sitting around the table in Brussels who 10 years or so ago decided that they wanted to join this club called the euro. They're now actually scratching their heads and wondering whether it was such a good idea.
The euro, or the single currency, is one of the main planks, if you like, of this European project. To have a single state, which is what the end product of the EU is, you must have a single currency, hence the introduction of the euro. Gladly, we didn't join. You're asking my opinion on the state of the euro now. I believe that the single currency had within its own self the seeds of its own destruction. You cannot possibly have a one-size-fits-all for 27 nations that make up the European Union, because each nation has got its own cycle of trade, etc. So it was always going to fail. There have been 10 attempts in history to create a single currency down through the years. Everyone has failed. I honestly believe that we are seeing the last days of the euro as it stands at the moment.
What about this idea that possibly the euro is actually an attempt, by binding these nations together financially, it's actually an attempt to sort of bind them together politically, to actually get them to make similar sorts of decisions around what gets taxed in each individual country and how the politicians relate to their individual people in the individual nations?
We are at what the European Union calls the Great Leap. They have to make one more great leap, and that is to seize control, if you like, of the nation states, first of all within the Eurozone, then within the EU. In other words, these nation states must cease to be nation states and just become a series of provinces or regions within the greater state that is Europe. In order to have that, they've got to have a single currency. What they've done is they've put the currency in place and hoped that the political joining together would happen. It hasn't. And that's why they find themselves in this bind. They haven't really got the authority and the power now to enforce this. That's why you're seeing all these hesitations taking place.
Now, Trevor, as someone that walks the corridors in Brussels and Strasbourg, tell us what you think is going to happen at the end of all this. Do you think that there is going to be a greater political union and a continuation of monetary union, or is it all going to fracture apart and the various different countries go back to their currencies like the Deutschmark and the Drachma?
I don't think that it'll be a matter of choice. I think it'll be circumstances will decide precisely what will happen. You may remember Britain was in something called the ERM, the exchange rate mechanism, in the early 90s, which was a precursor for the euro. It didn't work. Our country almost went bankrupt and we had to leave. I think exactly the same thing will happen in the eurozone. Nations will not accept these austerity measures and they will revert, I believe, some of them back to their original currencies. And once that begins to happen, I think the dominoes will start to fall and the whole project, it may take a few years, but the whole project, I think, is doomed.
Well, interesting. Now, Martin Summers, let me bring you in here and get your take on the developments this week in this ongoing week-by-week, month-by-month euro crisis, as it's called. We've had the Germans this week attempting to issue bonds in Germany, in euros, really to prop up their economy, and it hasn't gone too well, has it?
No, I think that is definitely the writing on the wall. And the problem is that the collapse of the euro is also the collapse of the international banking system. The US and British banks are massively exposed through the derivatives market to the eurozone. So although the bomb goes off in Brussels, if you like, the reverberations are going to go around the world, just like the shot in Sarajevo that started World War One. This is the problem, is that we're now in a situation where best solutions are no longer feasible, and we're probably going to have, I mean, it's not just the European Union that's out of touch with ordinary people. We've got a transnationalised financial elite, we've got a military industrial complex in the US which soaks up all of their taxes. Basically, ordinary people are squashed out of these decisions, and the European Union, originally conceived as a kind of humanistic project, if you like, has been captured by vested interests. It was always going to be the way. I mean, basically, the bankers and Goldman Sachs have just appointed the government of Italy and the government of Greece. If there's an election in Italy or in Greece, neither of these guys would be in power. Basically, a governor has been put in from Brussels. But of course, the real big daddies on the block are the Americans, and they're the ones who tell everybody in Europe what to do. And the creation of the European Union in the 1940s was an attempt, particularly by the French civil service, to create a countervailing force.
Well, it was the iron and steel community back then.
Yes,
that
I know,
time,
but the point
it?
That
it's evolved
two main
over
purposes.
The years.
One is to actually bind Germany and France together, and don't forget they'd gone to war three times in three generations. And then also, of course, to break away from the American domination of the dollar. Now, of course, the original conception of the euro was that it would not include these southern European countries. And when they signed the Treaty of Rome, the Italians, for political reasons, insisted that they had to be in on it. And the original founders of the EU just wanted it to be a German-French thing with the Dutch and the Belgians included. They didn't want the Italians in, but the Italians for political reasons. And the Americans said, no, the Italians have got to be in for political reasons, but they should never have been allowed in the first place. Now, what may happen of this crisis, and I think probably the best solution, would be if the Germans leave the Eurozone and go back to the Deutschmark, because that will be much less destructive than other countries trying to leave the euro, go back to the drachma, for example. Because the first thing that happens if you're in Greece and you say we're going back to the drachma is you have a run on the banks and everybody loses their savings. Now, if the Germans say they're going to leave, it's less likely that that will happen. And then you'd have the Germans trading with a hard Deutschmark against the eurozone.
Can you just explain this week's bond issue, though? Why do countries issue bonds like that?
Because they want money. I mean, most countries... I mean, Britain has had a national debt since the Napoleonic Wars. Every modern country has got a national debt. But you can't let it get completely out of control, but that's the way the world works. And therefore, on a regular basis, countries borrow money from the markets in order to pay their bills.
And the Germans have actually only got two-thirds that they expected to get for that bond issue, which is actually a considerable...
The suspicion that legs have been broken by people in Washington to make sure the Germans are punished, because what the British and the Americans want.
So,
are
you saying that? So, you're saying that other parts of Europe and the United States are punishing the Germans somehow by not buying their bonds?
What they want Angela Merkel to do, and this is what the bankers want her to do, is switch on the money press. I mean, the Bank of England switched on the money press a long time ago. The US switched on the money press. The Germans don't believe in quantitative easing because of the history of the country. And Angela Merkel is basically...
Is this because they had that massive hyperinflation
in the past, and so on in the 20s, and they're just not prepared to do it. And frankly, I can't see that there is a case for bailing the banks out again. They've had 4 years. They were bailed out the first time. They were supposed to get their act together. They didn't. And I don't think there's any case for bailing them out again. But the consequence of that is not just going to be a breakup of the Eurozone. It's going to be a worldwide financial collapse, and in many countries it's going to mean civil war, hopefully not in this one.
Trevor, what's your take on that? I think Martin's maybe pushing it a bit extreme there. Polly Winch, who was in a few weeks ago, was saying Martin's scaremongering a bit. But what's your take on the actual effects for ordinary people in the street?
Martin knows much more about these matters than I do. I'm not an economist. All I would say to you is this, that we should never have been in this position in the first place. To hand over power and to continue to support the handover of power to the centralised power of the EU is a dreadful thing for this country. I think Martin is right when he says that this is going to cause a lot of trouble, particularly for people in the street. There's no question about that. It's always the poor that get hit, and I believe that will happen. But I believe, unfortunately, this is a process that has to take place. As I say, this was always flawed, and this day was bound to arrive.
As someone from the UK Independence Party, don't you feel a bit weird being part of a party which is actually just set up to say no to something?
Actually, we're not to say no to something. We're actually here to say yes to sovereignty and to self-government. We believe in that, and I happen to believe that the people of this country have the ability and the energy and the imagination to be a great nation again. But we can only do that if we govern ourselves.
Now, you've just mentioned the European Commission, the commissioners who are appointed, the Parliament, which consists of MEPs like yourself. What are the other major institutions as part of the EU?
You have the European Council, which meets with the ministers from the nation states. They're involved in the making of legislation.
Now, is that all ministers from all nation states?
Yes, it is. But what happens is that the minister with a portfolio for that particular topic will turn up on one day, and perhaps the next week you'll have another minister.
You may have, for example, all the defence ministers together. You may have all of the Home Office ministers or interior ministers.
Yes, that is so. The problem again is that transparency and knowing precisely what they're deciding and who decides what. And again, there's too much secrecy and a lack of transparency for all these procedures.
But what's the problem there? Because all of these people from all over Europe are elected in their own way, aren't they? In different countries. They're all elected people.
That's an argument that's used for a lot of posts in the EU, but they're not elected to do that. People don't elect people at general elections to go to Brussels and Strasbourg and decide on policy over there. They just don't do that. They elect them to represent them in the constituencies in this country, not realising, of course, that this, if you like, supranational level of government overarches everything.
Now, what about the idea of a European army? Because I know up in Gloucestershire we've got a barracks there with, I think it's in Cheltenham,
isn't it? It's in Innsworth. My sister used to live there, yeah.
Okay.
It's the NATO rapid reaction form.
And they are from all different countries, aren't they, from all over Europe. Is there a possibility, you think, in the future that we'll have a kind of Euro-EU army?
If the EU continues to exist, there's no question about it that that will happen.
And what about a police force, a sort of, you know, civil police rather than a military?
There is the construction already of the EU gendarmerie, which is not the traditional way we police in this country. So what you must understand is that most things British must go. We must conform and be the same as the rest of the EU, and much of what we do, because we're Anglo-Saxons, is totally different than what happens on the continent. Part of that is the way we police ourselves, and there will be, if it continues to exist, and I must keep on adding this, Ryder, if the EU continues to exist, our system of policing will change.
In what way would it change?
Many of the safeguards that are in place now, which have been handed down to us down through the centuries, will have to go. For example, if we're charged with a serious offence, we can elect trial by jury. That's not necessarily so on the continent. We've also got something called the writ of habeas corpus, which means we can't be locked away for any great length of time without charge. Again, that doesn't apply on the continent. There is a new system of criminal justice in the EU called corpus juris, and it means really the abandonment of most of the safeguards we have, and the introduction of a European system of criminal justice.
And what is this corpus juris then? Because I think many of us question whether our justice system works effectively in this country, and maybe possibly open to a new system if it works better than what we've got.
Well, let me give you a classic example of the kind of thing that may be coming our way. Well, is already our way, and that's the European arrest warrant. When I was in the police service, if I had someone who was arrested, for example, in Scotland, or I wanted arrested in Scotland or outside England, I would have to go to a magistrate in this country and swear on oath and produce evidence on oath of a prima facie case against that person. If the magistrate thought there was prima facie evidence, that magistrate would issue me with a warrant. I would go to Scotland or France or wherever, and I would appear in front of a magistrate there and go through the same procedure. And if the local magistrate thought that, again, I had a prima facie case, we could execute the warrant, and we would do that. Now, under the European arrest warrant, there are 32 offences listed on the warrant. It's a tick-box warrant. You just tick the offences that you think a person, Joe Smith, has committed. You then go before a magistrate in this country, and as long as the magistrate is happy that it is one of the tick-box offences and that Joe Smith is the person that you're after, that's it. You haven't got to produce any evidence on oath. Correct. You haven't got to produce any evidence on oath. You've merely got to show that you consider that this tick box offence has been committed, and that person can be arrested and taken back to wherever it is. So you will see that much of the safeguards that we have in this country will have to go.
Now, I'm glad you mentioned the European arrest warrant, Trevor, because yesterday in Parliament there was a debate about this. This is at Westminster Hall, and there were some of the MPs were a bit sniffy about the fact that there hadn't been a proper debate in the House of Commons. It was about the European arrest warrant, and it was also about the extradition arrangements with the United States. So let's have a quick listen now to part of today in Parliament, or yesterday in Parliament, depending on whether you listen to it, from yesterday.
MPs have called for greater protection for British citizens accused of crimes in the European Union and the United States. In a debate in Westminster Hall, there was criticism from all sides of the current arrangements, which MPs said made it too easy for the US and EU to extradite people from the UK. Here's Simon Jones.
There was an unusual amount of cross-party consensus in Westminster Hall that there had to be substantial reform to the UK-US extradition treaty and to the European Arrest Warrant, or EEWA. There's been persistent criticism of both and calls for British courts to have greater discretion to refuse extradition requests from the American authorities. MPs also want the ability to remove someone from the UK under an EEWA to be limited to cases where that person will definitely face trial. The Conservative MP Dominic Raab said the extradition treaty with the US was flawed.
In practice, as it affects our respective citizens, the arrangements have been practically all one way.
Mr. Raab cited the case of Gary McKinnon, who has Asperger's syndrome. He's fighting extradition to the US after allegedly hacking into defence computers in search of evidence of aliens.
More misfit than terrorist he should not be equated with some high-level Al-Qaeda suspect or gangster.
Other MPs raised the case of Baba Ahmed. He's been in jail for 7 years without charge while challenging extradition to the US on terrorism charges. 140,000 people have signed an official e-petition calling for him to be tried here. Labour's Andrew Slaughter described his situation as Kafkaesque.
It's been described by one of the judges who's considered the case as an ordeal. A British citizen has spent 7 years in high security prisons without any charge being brought against them. And that fact alone, I think, should shock all members present here today.
Other MPs turned their fire on the EU arrest warrant. The Conservative, Zach Goldsmith, recounted the tale of Deborah Dark, who was pursued by the French authorities for 20 years for a crime she was convicted of in her absence, a decision she was not informed about until her arrest at gunpoint in Turkey. There was criticism, too, of the decision to hold the debate in Westminster Hall rather than in the main Commons chamber. Earlier this month, a review led by a former Court of Appeal judge, Sir Scott Baker, concluded that the arrangements with the US were not unbalanced and that the European arrest warrant was not used unfairly or oppressively. The Home Secretary, Theresa May, is considering his findings. Responding to the debate was the Immigration Minister, Damian Green.
I can't respond to the question various people have asked, given the exact timeline of when we will come to a decision, but this has been an extremely valuable debate which will play its own part in allowing the government to develop a response which we will, as the Home Secretary has said, produce as soon as practical.
Damian Green there, the Immigration Minister, ending that report from today in Parliament. Now, Trevor, that's pretty... actually, Damian sounded a little bit nervous there, didn't he, when he was saying that we will be looking at this, because, there's 7 years in jail with no charges as a result of one of these extradition treaties, rather like the European arrest warrant.
In relation to the European arrest warrant, there is nothing that our country can do about the European arrest warrant without going back to the Commission and getting all 27 member states to agree on the changes to any European arrest warrant. One thing I didn't add when I spoke earlier on was this, that the European arrest warrant can apply to conduct that is not a criminal offence in this country. And so our people in this country can be arrested for offences that aren't offences in this country and taken abroad for that. So in relation to the European arrest warrant, there is little they can do because we are part of the co-signees on that. As far as the American extradition warrant is concerned, all I can say is that it does appear to be one-sided at the moment. Mainly our citizens are being extradited as opposed to the Americans.
Martin Summers, this is beginning to sound a bit like a police state here, because we're in a situation where if you are in a specific job, you're appointed to a job, you're given a piece of paper with tick boxes on it, and you tick that piece of paper, you can get anybody across the whole of Europe arrested.
Well, there's another aspect to this which people need to notice, is that other EU citizens in Britain are often arrested. I understand. I lived in Poland for many years, and of course, what the Polish police do is they just stick out a European arrest warrant for people who've got parking fines and so on. Yeah. And of course, the British police are then running around catching Polish lads who are over here working as plumbers or whatever for traffic offences in Britain, which, you know, the Poles particularly abuse the system, and it annoys the police here because basically they're wasting their time on trivial. You know, you should only go to an extradition with people who are really seriously worth extraditing. It's not worth putting British police time. And the British basically play ball. If they get a European arrest warrant, they go after whoever it is. But when they get annoyed when they arrest this guy and find out what it is a parking fine from 5 years ago, because that's a waste of police time in Britain, isn't it? Let's face it.
Well, Trevor, how do we get out of this sort of treaty, which seems to be make a mockery of any idea of justice?
We can't get out of any of the treaties. There is a thing called the ratchet system. As soon as we hand over to the European Union powers, which they define as competences, as soon as we hand that over, it can never be returned. And in the whole history of our association with this dreadful thing, not one jot or tittle has ever been changed by us, because we can't do it. We need unanimity to do this, and we're not going to get it.
But many of the other nations around Europe, they seem to sort of juggle this a little bit better than we do. I mean, we had the shutting down of Bombardier, the train makers up north, because Britain was sticking to all this stuff by the letter, whereas in many of the other European countries, they would just simply find excuses to skip over these obligations to make sure that they're looking after their own industries.
Well, as I said earlier on, we tend to play a straight bat with all these things and gold plate these regulations and directives. The other thing, of course, is that because we are so different than most continental countries, we see the difference here, whereas with them, some of the stuff, of course, is already normal practice over there.
Okay. Martin, what's your thought finally on this whole EU police state business? Because I'm really pretty worried to see this European arrest warrant where just if I'm in a situation where I've got a piece of paper, I'm in a specific desk job somewhere, then I can just tick a box without having to produce any evidence and get anybody arrested.
Well, I'm no defender of this, but I think people have got to be realistic and understand what the real threats to liberty are. We've got a number of people in this country being held under our regulations without habeas corpus, so-called terrorists, including Haroon Rashid Aswat, named by the Metropolitan Police as the mastermind on 7/7.
But he's being held because the Americans want to extradite him.
Oh, yes, indeed. But no, he's actually being held incommunicado in Broadmoor, and of course he's been named by the US authorities as an MI6 double agent. Now, what's going on is that there is power grabs going on in Brussels, power grabs going on in Washington, power grabs going on in London. And London is at the heart of a global financial system. You know, what goes on in Britain affects everybody everywhere. And don't forget, I mean, I'm not a supporter of UKIP because people in Wales and Scotland and Ireland in particular don't necessarily identify with England or with the UK. What we really need is decentralisation of power to a level where people are happy with it. And that could include the breakup of the UK, but not necessarily inside the EU. My favourite European country is Norway. They've never been inside the EU. The reason being that the EU isn't socialist enough for them, and they want proper socialism, and that's what they have in Norway. They've got a nationalised oil industry, and it's going to keep their kids in nursery schools for a generation. Good for them.
Trevor, I want to hear a bit of light at the end of the tunnel from you about how... I don't believe it's possible to have a ratchet system where you can only go one way. That may be the legal position, but surely at some point Britain as a whole can just say, maybe even through some sort of referendum, can say, no, we've had enough of this.
Yes, I agree with you. The problem is, you see, that most of this has been hidden from the British nation for the last 38 years. That was a deliberate policy. Papers that have been suppressed for 30 years show us that the Foreign and Commonwealth Office told the ministers of the day not to tell the people what was happening. And that's why this has been allowed to happen. No, at the end of the day, it's the people who will decide. I go along with what Martin said, as long as the people are the ones who decide what they want. If that's allowed to happen, I think there's salvation for this country.
Can I just make a final point, which is that, for example, when Britain nationalised Northern Rock, EU regulations said that they couldn't nationalise a bank, and the Labour government was being told by the European Commission, oh, you can't nationalise a bank, that's terrible, terrible. But of course they had to do it because there was nothing else to be done. And then when they had to nationalise their banks again, see, all the EU Maastricht Treaty stuff on the economic side, it's all being ripped up. I mean, for the Germans to print money, they've got to rip up the Lisbon Treaty. And the Germans basically are quite legalistic and saying, no, the legal position is that we're not allowed to print money. We've designed the European Central Bank to be like the Bundesbank. We don't print money. And of course, the Americans and the British are going, bonkers, if you don't print money, the banks are going to collapse. And the Germans are going, well, let them collapse then. But of course, the consequences of a banking collapse are going to make the breakup of the euro look like a Sunday afternoon tea party.
Well, finally, Trevor, we've got a little treat for you. Marina Morris has been out and about on the streets of Bristol this week to ask you, the listeners, the public, what do you think of the European Union?
What are the good and bad points about the European Union?
Close to home, a terrible squabble over jobs. The influx of particularly Eastern Europeans and the job market, I think, is horrific.
I guess advantages are closer ties with the rest of Europe, you know, sort of for trade and all that sort of thing. A prevention of disagreements, which might lead to sort of world wars, that sort of thing. Disadvantages, financial differences.
Because that's great to me. I think it's good to have trading partners within the same areas. I think it's got a good future. If we can only stick with it.
The good point is about community and having a group of countries talking to each other more closely. The bad points may be obviously the economic, sometimes the economic side that we can see in the news at the moment.
An advantage would be that, you know, everybody in the EU gets an opinion, gets a say, gets to hear their voices heard. I suppose a bad point would be that not everybody agrees at least attention, and you know, policies that are erected don't often agree with everybody in the EU.
It's easier to trade, and I guess having the euro DNHS thing as well, I think that there's an agreement, isn't there, when you're sick in other countries, there's rights you have in one kind of moved across, aren't they, that kind of thing. Bad things, I mean, Germany kind of has taken the role of dictating to everybody else. I think it's a bit, it must be very difficult to be Greek or Italian right now.
Should we be in the euro so David Cameron can contribute to a solution?
No. Just looking at the mess that the eurozone's in at the moment, we're better off out of it.
No, I don't think we should. I think we should stick to the pound, to be honest. I don't like the idea of being one European nation. I don't like the idea of closer European ties. You know, there's too many differences in the nations to be fiscally together, I think. That's the problem. I think that's what's happened at the moment. I think that's the issue now.
Well, the difficulties, obviously, with the money at the moment are dragging everybody down. I'm afraid that it would have a rather detrimental effect, but...
For now, it's a good point not to be, because they're more independent and don't have that many economic difficulty linked to the euro.
In my opinion, the euro was never really going to work, because you've got all those different countries with different growth rates, different interest rates. It was a bit of an iffy one, really. I think in hindsight we did the right thing by keeping out of it, but the problems that we're facing at the minute, David Cameron can't really avoid getting involved to help out.
I really like the fact that you don't have to keep changing your money when you go abroad.
What should the Chancellor George Osborne do about this seemingly never-ending banking crisis?
I'd like to see the banking restrictions in place a lot longer than 2020 that they're proposing. You know, I think that should happen much sooner and get some sort of grip on them.
I think to continue with what they're doing. The country's got to be able to afford what it can achieve, and I think, you know, cutting back a little bit and saving money when they can and trying to encourage growth where they can. But I think, you know, I don't think there's a lot else they can do.
I think the Cabinet's got to make a decision about which way we go and stick to it. So George Osborne's got to find a direction for that and go that way too. We can't just dither. We've got to get on with it.
Talk to people, get opinions of solutions that would be feasible to resolve the banking crisis, because I feel that the top management of each country is trying to find each a solution in their own country and from their own government. But maybe if they were talking to each other and talking maybe to more economists and people that have an economical background,
you could tax the banks a little bit heavier in terms of their bonuses and whatnot. Perhaps a bit more legislation on their operations, what they can and can't do. I mean, at the end of the day, it was them being irresponsible that got us into this mess in the first place. But you know, it's not just the banks; everybody got involved in it. Really, you know, the banks were lending to us, but yes, we were happy enough to, you know, take up those loans that we couldn't afford.
Tax the rich. There's plenty of money about in this country. There's plenty of money about. It just isn't distributed fairly. I just think there's greed at the top of the ladder. The bankers, as we can see, and the chief execs will give themselves lots of money.
That was you and your views on the EU and the euro crisis. Talking to Marina Morris on the streets of Bristol earlier on in the week. Trevor, what are your impressions about what you heard there? Because we've heard the main thought from the people Marina spoke to there about the euro is they're fed up with all this dithering around.
I think I wouldn't presume to tell the people of Bristol or anywhere else what they should or shouldn't do as far as the European Union is concerned. All I would say is this: people must realise the price we pay for belonging to this club, and the price is that we are governed by 27 people we don't elect, that we can't get rid of, who aren't accountable to us, who are foreign, and who meet in private and secret and make laws that govern us. As long as the people of this country realise that that's the price we pay, I'm quite content to settle for whatever they decide to do.
But does the UK Independence Party not recognise the benefits of Europe? That is to say, what we were just hearing there, the fact that it's so convenient using the euro, the fact that the EU has made it so much easier to trade around Europe, that all the voices around Europe are now heard?
I'm not at all sure that those advantages do exist. I'm not convinced by that anyway. But let's just say, for the sake of argument, that they do. That's still one heck of a price to pay.
What are your thoughts about the immigration there? Because that was brought up as well. We're certainly in the situation now where it's very much easier for people in other parts of the EU to now come and live and work in Britain.
And that is in fact happening. I believe that because we're a small island, that it's a question of space, not race, and that we should adopt similar policies that they have in Australia and New Zealand, Canada, etc., where we check exactly what's going on with people coming to this country and leaving. There's nothing wrong with that. That's good housekeeping.
Martin, what about you? Can I hear your views on what you heard there, and particularly on some of the positive things that people were saying? Because we've been a bit negative about the EU today, about things like trade and the fact that it's so convenient.
I used to work in Eastern Europe in the 1990s, and when I first used to go over there to Poland and to Russia, well, not so much to Russia, but to Hungary and Romania, they were all keen to be in the EU because from their point of view, they saw it as a bulwark against the Russians.
Yeah.
And I remember having fierce arguments with them saying, but if you go into the EU on the terms that's being offered, you're going to cut your own throat. And in actual fact, for example, in Poland, their farming sector was destroyed because they're small farmers, and they were not allowed to they didn't have the money to subsidise their farmers, and they could get subsidies, but there was a cut off on the amount of subsidy they would get. So basically, they're made to compete on an open playing field with subsidised farmers from Britain and from France and so on, and they can't compete, and the farmers were all bankrupted. That's about a third of the population in Poland. But the middle class, the go-ahead sections of the society were all keen to be in the EU club because they saw it, you know, for them it was a positive move. But for a lot of the factory workers and for the less well-off, it was not such a good move. They'd have been better to make haste slowly. And what I used to say to them is, make them beg for you to join the EU. Don't throw yourself at their feet. And then you can get a better deal if you do decide to join. But of course, that wasn't the thinking at the time. People were still so scared of the Russians that they just wanted to jump. And you've got to remember that the EU project as a whole, however messed up it's become, was originally conceived as a way to keep Europe at peace. And you've got to remember that there's been two world wars started in Europe in the last 100 years. And the possibility of those wars is still there. I used to be an aid worker in Yugoslavia, and people who were neighbours and friends who'd lived with each other for years, as soon as the economy collapsed, everybody suddenly noticed how different everybody else was. And I think the Greeks today are saying, we remember the occupation of the Germans in the war, and now you're trying to tell us what to do. You know, all of these antagonisms are still there and are still dangerous.
Trevor, is there any possibility, do you think, that the European Union, the way it's set up at the moment, can be steered in a better direction? Because clearly there is a problem with a democratic deficit, that we're dealing with people in power who are appointed there rather than elected there. So can we see reform? Could that work with the EU?
I don't think so. If you listen to the debates, and I use that term within inverted commas, if you listen to the debates that take place in the Parliament, where the Commission come and debate things with the European Parliament, there is only one way for them, and that is the solution to everything is more Europe, more Europe. They say that. That's the term they use. It doesn't matter if you tell them it's not working. And it's causing hardship. They say, well, if we have more Europe, more control, more competences, we can make it work. No, I think they've gone too far down the road to change now. They're set on their ways, they know precisely what they want, and they're still going to try and get it.
Well, UKIP MEP for the South West, Trevor Coleman, thanks very much for joining us on Drive Time. And now we're going to have a listen to a report about next week's strike. Yesterday in Portugal, they had a general strike. Martin, can you just introduce maybe, before we hear the piece about next week's strike in the public sector, some of the background to this? Because we're hearing that actually one of the reasons that people are annoyed about the strike is because effectively it means a cut in their wages. If the pensions are rearranged, it's something like a 5-6% cut in their effective wage.
Yeah, basically people sign a contract when they decide to be a police officer or a nurse in their 20s or whatever, and they expect that that contract's going to be honoured, and it's not going to be honoured, and they're pretty angry that we've bailed the banks out, but we've got to pay the price. And in actual fact, it doesn't make sense to cut people's wages. That's the way to disaster. And what we need is the flexibility in each country to pursue reflationary policies in a coordinated fashion, but people don't have they don't trust the centre of Brussels to do it. It's got to be at local level. I mean, the Norwegians, as I said earlier, they talked hard about joining the EU, and they decided not to, partly because they got oil and they could take that decision, but we had oil as well. and we could have done something better with it than we did.
But this
the Norwegians
is this
are a
strike.
Small country, and they
this is not
with
about
everybody.
Europe, Martin. And this is about Westminster and about public sector pensions.
Oh
here.
Yes, I know. Well, I was just coming back to a bit of Europe because that's what the topic we've been on before. Obviously, people are angry. I mean, the head teachers are on strike. My dad used to be a head teacher in inner city Liverpool. People at that level are furious with the meddling that's gone on from the top by both Labour and Conservative governments, and now you're going to rip up our pensions. You need to go and have a word with yourself. That's what public sector workers are going to be saying next Wednesday.
Well, this is discussions about on this very topic yesterday. Let's go to Westminster.
At Prime Minister's question, some Conservative MPs raised the prospect of changing the law to increase the threshold in union ballots before action could be taken. Tory Gavin Barwell called for a debate on the strikes.
The sympathy that my constituents feel to public sector workers who are facing a freeze in their pay and changes to their pension contributions is going to be significantly eroded by the inconvenience and worse that will be caused by the proposed strikes. Can we have a debate on the legitimacy of those strikes so that we can see where the members opposite will stand up for their constituents or their paymasters?
Yeah.
Mr. Barwell was putting his question to the Leader of the Commons, Sir George Young, who was setting out the forthcoming business in the House. Sir George explained government thinking.
What we're trying to do is to get a fairer balance between the public sector employees and the taxpayer who pays a very large percentage of the pension contributions. I think my honourable friend raises a good point that I detect public sympathy ebbing away from those who are planning a strike, and they do well to reflect on that before they go ahead with their action on Wednesday.
But a veteran Labour MP, David Winnick, thought there ought to be a very different subject under discussion.
It cannot be useful to have a debate in the very near future on the obsessive hatred, there's no other way to describe it, that the Tory party has and always has had for the trade union movement.
Yeah. But Sir George thought that was unfair.
That is a travesty of my party's view about trade unions. I was a member of a trade union until I was expelled. I was described as a pinstriped bother boy by ASTEMS back in the 1970s.
So that was yesterday in Parliament on the subject of next week's strike for on public sector pensions. Martin, do you think there's any chance that between now and next Wednesday that there'll be some kind of settlement between
no,
the unions and the government?
None whatsoever. Both sides are spoiling for a fight. Because it's not just about pensions. The activist core within the trade union movement know that it's a pension strike, because that's what we've got to do. We've got to win a ballot on pensions, but it's actually about government policy. Like in France, we're basically saying to the government, you've got to go, we need a policy change. And that is the underlying thing that's going on here, which is why the trade unions shouldn't bottle it out. Public sympathy may or may not be there. In fact, you don't actually have to have public sympathy to go on strike. All you've got to do is have the support of your members. Now, of course, they would be wise to try and keep public with them, but at the same time, the time comes when you've got to stand up and defend yourself, and by defending yourself, you're also challenging the government, and the government needs to be challenged because they're about to crash the economy into the wall and they've got to be stopped.
One of the arguments that people are saying is that actually there's loads more people who are actually members of trade unions than are of political parties, and actually the trade unions, when they make decisions like this, are actually far more democratic than political parties are at their national conferences.
Well, there's a case to be made for that, but I think the unions would be foolish to be complacent about that. What you've got in this country is lots of people, particularly in the public sector, who are paper members of a trade union. Unlike the communications workers unions who were on strike at the television licensing centre last week, they haven't got a proper trade union consciousness. I mean, basically, unions have to be relevant, and to be relevant, you've got to do something. And, of course, a lot of trade unions basically have become bureaucratic. They don't do much. People just and people join because they when they're in trouble. We've got to get back to how it used to be, which is people understood what trade unions were for. And of course, what trade unions are ultimately for is to create a bottom to the society so that they can't just cut wages. The days when wages went up year on year were the good years in Britain, and the last 20-30 years wages haven't gone up year on year, and people have borrowed instead. it's much better to pay them more money rather than give them a credit card.
Now, one of the big problems at the top, one of the sort of democratic deficit themes in the Labour Party and Conservative and Lib Dems too, is the power of the lobbyists. And we heard this week on Channel 4 News that David Cameron has actually had done a land deal of some sort with one of the country's top chief executive, one of the country's top lobbying firms, and didn't declare it in his MP's register of interest, neither has he declared it as part of what he should have done as part of the ministerial code. So let's have a listen to this Channel 4 news report about the Werribee syndrome, which is Lord Chadlington, who lives opposite in Witney in Oxfordshire, the Prime Minister, and his lobbying firm represents big powerful businesses like the Carlyle Group, which we'll be hearing about in part two. But now over to this report from Channel 4 News.
We asked Downing Street. They said that there is no requirement to disclose or register this transaction. Because there was a record at the land registry, the information was already in the public domain. Lord Chadlington is chief executive of Huntsworth, whose lobbying clients include banking giants and companies with government contracts. He personally acts for a number of companies, including the food giant Associated British Foods, the Carlyle Group and the Stock Exchange.
How does it feel, Deputy Prime Minister?
The coalition agreement pledged to take action on lobbyists. David Cameron himself has spoken out on the issue.
I believe it's time we shone the light of transparency onto lobbying in our country and forced our politics to come clean about who is buying power and influence. It's the next big scandal waiting to happen.
Martin, that's a bit ironic, isn't it? David Cameron talking about the next great scandal waiting to happen, and now he's actually embroiled himself in a dodgy land deal which has actually benefited him personally, and he's now got a quite a larger area. It's actually a little bit of land that was part of his property in Oxfordshire he's managed to buy, so his house is going to be a lot more valuable as a result. That's surely this the sort of thing, especially when it's involved with a top national lobbyist, that he should be declaring.
Indeed, and of course the Carlyle Group is not just a lobbying group, it's a military industrial complex company.
Well, the lobbying company lobbies for the Carlyle Group.
Yes, indeed, and the Carlyle Group has got lots of ex-politicians, John Major for example, on its board. And where do they make their money? Oh, arms manufacture. Where do the contracts come from? Oh, the government. Who gives them those contracts? Oh, the politicians.
Well, Lord
Chadlington.
What
do the politicians get? Well, they get little favours like this, don't they?
Lord Chadlington, who he bought this land off, is the chief executive of one of Britain's largest public relations groups called Huntsworth. The group also owns a number of lobbying firms such as Quiller Consultants that act for the major financial, retail and telecoms companies in Britain. Lord Chadlington personally acts for several specific clients, including the Stock Exchange, Associated British Foods and the Carlyle Group.
Well, there you go. Basically, the problem in politics is that it's funded by the wealthy. So a politician, whoever they are, whatever political persuasion they are, has got two constituencies they've got to keep happy. One is the electorate, the other is the funders. Now, basically, in Scandinavia, places like Norway, they broke this nexus years and years ago. Politics is funded by the state. No outside money is allowed to come in, and it levels the playing field. In Britain, the Tories basically get loads of money from abroad. Foreign businessmen give them money. Lukas Shing, who's the biggest guy in Hong Kong, apparently Mark Thatcher phoned him up and said it's time to pay up for Mumsy, and he gave them a load of money. And there's all sorts of other things that go on because these people don't even notice that they're doing it. For them, it's business as usual. You scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. I mean, Werribee was wandering around as if he owned the place, because that's how they feel they are. They think they own the place. But of course, a lot of this is extremely dubious, and we've got to actually clean money out of our politics, and that's what's got to happen. And of course, that means that the Conservative Party's got to lose a lot of its funding.
Well, isn't that strange? That's exactly what David Cameron was saying there in that clip.
Yes, well, that's David Cameron talking one thing and doing another. Cameron speak with forked tongue.
Another interesting story this week, a sharp fall in new affordable housing. Well, I say a sharp fall. This is just 454 affordable houses were started in 6 months, compared with more than 13,000 in the same period last year. Delays caused by protracted contract negotiations between local authorities and the government resulted in just 450 new affordable houses being begun in the first 6 months of 2011 to 2012. The figure is 97% fewer fewer than in the same period last year. Now, that's a massive drop in affordable houses.
Yes, and what we should be doing is building a whole new generation of council houses, A, to get rid of our housing problem, B, to prevent any more property bubbles developing, and C, to put people to work. And that's what Labour should be saying. We need to reflate the economy by building houses for poor people and putting poor people in them and then paying them good wages afterwards.
Now, the figure for the South West is even worse, actually. In the South West, in the first 6 months of last year, it was 7,200 affordable houses were started. In the first 6 months of this year, it was only 22. And I sat and worked that out on my calculator. That is about 99.5% less than last year in the South West.
And people suggest that there's no difference between Labour and Conservative. I suggest they look at there's 97 or 99% difference, isn't there? Because this is exactly what we should be doing in this situation. And Ed Balls, to his credit, did discuss this in the Labour leadership election. We should have a crash house building programme, not for luxury houses, houses for poor people. And of course, the real point of doing that is to stop property bubbles developing. If you've got lots of nice quality housing for low income people, that will actually stop the middle class getting property bubble freebies, and that will actually be good for our economy, because that means we can start investing in proper things that to build and make, rather than in conservatories.
Okay, on to our next story, and the cruelty of the carers. Now, that's a fascinating headline in the Daily Mail this week. A damning report into home help for the elderly finds neglect so appalling some of the elderly people just wanted to die. Study uncovers financial abuse, with money systematically being taken by the people who are supposed to be looking after the pensioners. Pensioners being physically abused and talked over, and also patient in the 90s was put to bed at 2:45 p.m. by a carer. What are your thoughts about this? There's been a lot of changes in the way that elderly people are looked after, and now it seems, well, you could argue that they're not really being looked after at all properly here.
Well, I mean, I understand these are council homes, but in any case, whether they're council...
They're home visits as well.
Yeah, but I mean, the point is that the way we look after our old people shows what kind of a society we are. And if we're not prepared to put the resources in to have these people properly looked after, we should be ashamed of ourselves.
The inquiry follows a damning report by the Care Quality Commission in May, which raised serious concerns about the treatment of older patients in care homes and NHS hospitals. A wave of inspections was ordered to be carried out in 500 care homes for the elderly and 50 hospitals after inspectors found nurses and carers were failing to provide the most basic necessities. Similar failings were highlighted earlier in this year by the Health Service Ombudsman, who cited cases of patients left to become so thirsty they couldn't even cry for help. Well, the damning dossier includes, for example, a 78-year-old pushed back into her chair rather than spoken to and asked to sit back. A woman's weight which plummeted to 7 stone because she couldn't actually reach the food when the food was put down for her. A patient in her 90s put to bed in the afternoon, as I said before. We also had a man who was made to shower in front of naked in front of trainees. An elderly mother left in filthy bedding, and a carer ignored a blind man on the visit. So the blind man didn't even know that the carer had been into the home and prepared the food and put it in the fridge because he was blind, and the carer didn't actually come and speak to him.
Well, it's all appalling, isn't it? I mean, it's good that this report's come out and has pointed out all of these shortcomings. And we've really, as a society, we've got to actually ask ourselves what we value. Do we value 2 foreign holidays a year, or do we value our old people to be properly looked after?
Isn't the problem here that actually what the bottom line with the privatisation of these kind of services is money? It's no longer about care.
Yes, but the point about this is that these are publicly run organisations.
But
as
they contract out often to the private sector to do the care.
Of course. What we the home helps in Bristol are about to be privatised. What that means is that the private sector will take over their jobs at half the money. Now, if somebody is prepared to look after old folk, that's a very, very skilled job. They're on the way out. They're very irritable sometimes. It's a very, very skilled job, and the people who do it are heroes and heroines. And we should pay them appropriately and expect appropriate behaviour from them. We don't want a situation where we've just got people who are getting through the day on minimum wage and not doing their job properly. We should pay these people properly, and we should do a proper job.
Well, coming up now to the Sky News at 6, thanks to this week's guest we heard earlier, which was South West Region UKIP MEP Trevor Coleman. And the so-called Broadmead Bomber was dramatised on BBC Three this week, but how accurate was the interpretation? Plus, a rare treat for all of the military workers at BAE Systems or at MOD Procurement after the news.
This is BCFM 93.2, the community station for Bristol. Listen live online at bcfm.org.uk.